I would watch an entire movie of her being a pet medium.
Yeah.
Oh,
like, God. She has to solve some sort of a crime. Like, the only, like, there was a big murder and everybody died, including the pet dog. And she is the one who cracks the case because she communicates with the dog.
Yes. Or she has to divine from a case of tuna who poisoned the other tuna. And Jermaine steps back into the scene. Now he's like, he's gone from like wearing a robe and being concerned when taking a picture to like having a full, and this is a throwback, a pan suit on where he's got two horns and pan legs with the little goat feet. Mm-hmm. And he's like bare torsoed, but there's this weird happy trail that goes halfway up his chest and it goes into a V to the bottom of his pants. Oh my God.
And like she looks back at him as he's doing all of these poses. She's like,
what are you doing? He puts his hands on her, not violently, but like imploringly.
She's like, I don't want to do this. I don't feel comfortable with it. And as she's saying that, that's when Rudd and Barry come in. So going back to Joe versus the volcano, there was that scene between Joe and the first character that we see Meg Ryan in. When I first brought it up, I was like noticing in a lot of ways, it would be very easy for him to force himself to stay. And I make the comparison to Blade Runner and how Harrison Ford like literally does force someone to stay in his home.
Yeah.
This is a little bit weird in the sense that Kieran is, he's trying to seduce Julie.
Yeah, it feels manipulative.
Yeah, but at this point he's still trying to convince her and she's still saying no when the other two guys come in.
Yes, I will say that to his credit, it seems like he wants a consenting partner.
Mm-hmm.
He might have been imploring a little bit, but it didn't feel rapey.
Yeah. And that was kind of what I was trying to get back, is that it was a little bit creepy, but it was still consensual. He still was interested.
Yeah, he wanted it. He was under the impression they were broken up. Mm-hmm. He thought it was his turn to make a move.
Right. And he already kind of had a plan in his head from the sound of things, because he did say, I think at one point, that he was wanting to have sex with Julie.
Well, he said he always found her very sexually attractive.
Yeah.
And he still did.
Yeah.
So Barry's like, I'm gonna save the day. Don't sleep with Kieran. Yeah. He's got gonorrhea.
Which goes back
to the mango mouth thing I just told you guys about.
Yeah. And Kieran says, no, I don't have gonorrhea.
Well, she has gonorrhea. And then Tim says,
she doesn't have gonorrhea. And he's like, Tim says, nobody here has gonorrhea. And then
Steve Carell kind of like sideways. And he's like, I have gonorrhea.
And he says, you can get it by sitting on a bus.
No, you can't.
My ex-wife said that she got gonorrhea by sitting on a bus.
Yeah, so she, I think, was a little more like fast and loose with the, nope, I was going to say something Steve Carell would say. I'm going to say it just because Steve Carell, fast and loose with the poos.
At least it wasn't pus.
Oh, no. That's because nobody here has gonorrhea except for Steve Carell.
Yeah, and so Barry and Kieran leave the barn.
Can we have a minute alone to talk?
And what I like is they end up having the heart-to-heart, Barry and Kieran. And Kieran's just like, have you ever like spent 5 months with a goat?
Living as a goat.
Yeah.
He's a method artist.
Mm-hmm. And Barry says they eat whatever they want. They could probably eat a bicycle.
It could eat itself.
Yeah. I feel like I'm a goat who's halfway through eating itself. Barry's like, what are we talking about? And Kieran says, everything. Can we get a movie with just these two characters?
Yes, I would sign up for that 100%. Mm-hmm. An idiot trying to figure it out and like an artsy person who happens to be an idiot. Okay, so right now I'm kind of obsessed with Bo Burnham's Left and Right Brain song. And poor Jen has had to listen to it several times and probably at least once more today. But it's two halves of a brain having a conversation. It's worth looking up and it's very hilarious. Mm-hmm. But that's what I feel like in this scene, that they're these two halves of the same coin. It's just one is an idiot who's honest and one of them's maybe a kind of a genius, but is too vapid. And so like they play off each other so well. But it's what's broken in me. I don't really care about the romantic aspect of these guys back in the barn, being like, whatever they be. I'd rather we stick with the bench for another 5 minutes. And we are still 10 minutes away from dinner, at least.
Yeah. And then we see Rudd and Julie talking about everything. And Barry was the one who contacted Darla, and he's explaining everything. And she's just like, so everything's Barry's fault? And he's just like, look, Barry's a sweet guy.
And that's when Barry steps in and starts eavesdropping after he's a sweet guy.
Right. And he hears Paul Rudd saying some not nice things about
him. Yeah, he's an idiot who's blown up my life, essentially.
He's just a tornado of destruction is what he calls him.
I've been that to people's lives.
And then Paul Rudd turns around to see Barry there, and he goes after Barry.
Well, and she noticed. She saw him standing behind him and let him say those evil things. Mm-hmm. His only friends are mice because they can't get away. And he's like, you know what my dead mice can't also do? Lie. And then he walks away. And I think this had to be Carell. He walks to the pond at the farm, and he walks straight into the water. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know about you, but if I'm feeling like a whirlwind of emotions, specifically when I have a panic attack, I'll feel overheated. And if I'm driving or something, I'll open the window, even if it's raining. And that cold blast gives me a sensory shock that helps me calm down. So if he was overheating like I do, walking into the pond with your shoes on and everything makes perfect sense. Yeah. And Paul Rudd's credit, he walks in right after him.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. I'm not mad about that.
Yeah. And so they have a heart-to-heart.
He goes, I know you were like, how am I going to fix my life? I'm going to find an extremely talented taxidermist and hit him with my car and then invite him to dinner, and that's going to fix your business.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, Tim goes, you know, I want you to know that the bad guy got it coming to him this time. Mm-hmm. And then Steve Carell holds up his finger and thumb, and he's like, well, the world's smallest violin being played just for you.
Yeah.
Oh, I know. This is so arrogant. I don't care. I'm going to make it about me. When I was a kid, one of the big steps I took to learning how to defend myself against who all of these people who I thought were attacking me all the time was to take an insult I heard on TV and memorize it so that I would have something to say when somebody was cruel to me. So the way he delivers that world's smallest violin was me in sixth grade throwing back some your mama joke at some kid who was being a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
And it hurts. I saw it. I felt it. I was like, oh God, I am Steve Carell. From gullible to quoting bully lines back at them. Oh, Barry.
But isn't that kind of the case? Like, I don't know about you, but I feel like it has taken me all of my 20s and half of my 30s to actually feel like I'm more of an adult. Like, there are moments when I was a kid and I would just blow up and I'd, like, get really emotional over all these little things. And I found that that was kind of my life in my 20s as well. It took me a long time to really kind of come out of that. Like, you don't have to have an emotional breakdown over every little thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is the first instance where we kind of see Barry snapping back and not necessarily getting angry at someone, but coming back and being like, yeah, you are a bit of a jerk, because we didn't see it with Thurman. Mm-mm. Thurman got right into his head. He was broken up about Martha.
Mm-hmm.
But he's always just kind of been a go with the flow sort of thing.
This is the thing that I identify with. And I, again, let's just zero in on the meanness of it, right? Okay, so you know how I think everybody's autistic? And that's not to detract from people who have, like, legitimate diagnoses under the autistic umbrella. It's just that it is an umbrella. And within a spectrum, everybody lands somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're really honest, you land on the LGBTQA 1±.
Right.
Everybody lands somewhere on a spectrum. And one of my blind spots that kind of lines up with some aspects of autism, which is a social awareness, right? One of mine is, it's hard for me to look at somebody else's intentions if they're not similar to mine. It's how I know that if I'm mad at somebody, they're probably doing something that I do,
mm-hmm.
which sucks, because when you become aware of that, everything is why you're a douchebag. But there was this aspect of it when I was a kid where I was just waiting for other people to ruin my life. And I was like, why is it that I feel like I'm trying my hardest and this other person is choosing to walk on me? If we're all trying our hardest, why would that person walk on me? Now, as an adult, I'm like, oh, everybody is trying their hardest. It's just I have different placement and perspective. And so most of the time, people aren't trying to walk on you, and that makes perfect mm-hmm. sense. But what I get from Barry in this scene and why my heart breaks for him is because he seems like he's trying his hardest, and he just can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And people keep walking on him, and now he realizes it, that it's not just him failing. He's trying his hardest and failing.
It's that Barry is a legitimately nice person. He wants what's best for people. Mm-hmm. He's honest about that. Mm-hmm. He, even if you see him as an idiot about certain areas, in the areas that actually count, he is open. He's trustworthy. Mm-hmm. He's loyal. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, he met Paul Rudd literally a day ago. Mm-hmm. And he is there with him, making sure that he, you know, he gets his girlfriend back.
Yeah, he's working a bit through his own catharsis, but right. He's there with genuinely good intentions.
Right. Everybody else who's just bringing these schmucks to dinner, they don't really care about these people. No. Because if they did, they would see them as beyond their intricacies, beyond their
eccentricities.
Hmm. And they would see them as actual people and they wouldn't be having this dinner at all.
Yes. They're just bringing this spectacle that I can't wait to talk about. But mm-hmm. We've still got like 35 more minutes of before dinner.
Yeah. No, I think we're getting close to dinner, though. You know what's interesting? Hmm. There's a lot of moments where people flip off someone else. Barry never once flips off someone else. He's metaphorically flipping off Paul Rudd in this moment.
Closest thing he was the world's tiniest violin.
Mm-hmm. But he also does call sex dirty, dirty sex.
Yeah, so. Well, he's a little naive.
Yeah. But Barry goes home, sad montage of him.
He walks into his lonely house. Mm-hmm. He walks past his beautifully lonely fish, mm-hmm. walks to his workshop.
And he throws the Paul Rudd mouse into the trash and starts trashing other things.
Well, it's a storage bucket, but we could call it a trash can because that's basically what he's doing. I don't know if you've ever done this, but been like disillusioned with a project and done the sad, angry cleanup. Mm-hmm. It sucks. I don't like it when you shove stuff in a box and we're like, well, this was a dream that's dead now. Like,
And then he goes over to the scenery of the mouse, the mice couples.
Yeah.
And he just looks at it pensively and he gets a bit of a second wind.
Okay. So he grabs the chest. He pulls the chest out. But like my notes say, I know what will fix this. Mice.
He uses his hobby to make himself feel better. And what is it? Rudd gets home. He gets a call about the dinner, which I'm like, finally.
Right. And it's his boss. And he's just like, where are you? I heard what happened.
And he puts the...
I heard what happened at brunch.
Yeah. And he puts the Swiss guy on the phone and...
You didn't tell me that he was your fool.
Yeah.
We have a similar tradition in Sweden called dinner con Örnenschlagen. And I looked it up and it does mean fool or somebody you could take advantage of.
Yeah.
Which is more of a schmeal than a schmuck, but that's part one of this episode.
Yeah. Rudd goes over to the dinner, fully prepared at this point to be like, look, it fell through. I'm here to own my mistake. But who should be there but Barry?
He knew the address. Remember, he'd been there yesterday because mm-hmm. that's when he thought the dinner was.
Right.
And he's like chatting up these people. And I know I should stop identifying with Barry. But like, okay, you know how my mouth won't stop? And if I'm nervous, it's especially bad. If you've seen me at a dinner with people I don't know, I look like very animated and in control of the conversation. But really, my brain's just like, what will get rid of your anxiety? How are you going to impress these people? Is there something that you can common ground with them? And you should find them. And I just whirl on it, right? But here's the thing. I can pull it off sometimes because I faked it a long time.
Mm-hmm.
He's what I would sound like if I couldn't fake it. And so when he's like, oh yeah, I would just call myself an eternal optometrist. I was like, identifiable nervousness. That one hurt a lot. And he's talking to Jeff Dunham.
Who is Lewis and his wife is Diane. And because it's Jeff Dunham, that means his wife is a puppet.
She's this old lady glam puppet drag looking thing with like this buxom red dress and boobs and stuff.
Yeah. They also have a pet medium, a beard champion, a guy whose vulture eats out of his mouth, and a blind fencer. Barry's like, you didn't tell me that like this was going to be a dinner for some of the most interesting people in the world. And I'm like, thank you, Barry.
100%. Seriously. I would eat a dinner alone with each of these people.
Mm-hmm.
To be at a table with these people mm-hmm. would be an exquisite delight.
Yeah. And so everybody's kind of showcasing their talents. The blind fencer is like, if you lose your sight, then all of your other senses are heightened, which isn't entirely true, but that's not the point of the movie.
Oh, Chris O'Dowd.
Mm-hmm. And they bring out lobster and the pet medium puts her hands over it. And she is talking like she is the dead lobster.
Oh, she's the first one to go, isn't she?
Yeah. And let's see. the beard guy is just, his beard is like...
It's a handlebar mustache separated into four different pieces on each side, and they're curled up together.
Thank you. It looks like an octopus.
It really does. The 2007 beard champion. Mustache champion? Mustache.
Beard. I had it down as a beard
champion.
You're probably
right.
But it was like, yeah, it looks like Cthulhu. That's pretty cool.
I have in my notes, obviously, I want to go to this dinner.
Yeah. So everybody's kind of showing off their hobbies and their talents.
That's when, what's her face? From The Help. What's her face?
Octavia Spencer.
Yes. That's when Octavia Spencer puts her hands over her dinner, which is a split lobster.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That lobster looked delicious. Did you feel like that?
Oh, yeah. Like, I was like, I totally understand why nobody would want to eat it, but I would probably be wanting to chow down on
it
too.
It's a split roasted lobster with herb crusting and drawn butter.
And like,
it looks so good. I was like, oh no.
Octavia Spencer is selling it. Like, selling it.
Okay, so she's a pet medium who talks to dead pets. And so earlier she had been talking to the vulture guy and was like, I would like to. Oh, and the vulture guy is a guy who plays the villain in Happy in the last season.
Actor's name is Patrick Fischler.
Patrick Fischler plays, he's not the Easter Bunny killer. It's just that it's the Easter season of Happy. The next one's Halloween. I'm super excited to watch Happy again when things get back to me getting what I want all the time. But he lets his vulture eat out of his mouth. And she was like, oh, your vulture's mother wants to tell him something. And then she starts going, rah, rah, rah. And then we're at dinner. And she puts her hands over the lobster and she's like, and like Perry's like, she's talking to the lobster. Except she's not talking to the lobster, she's channeling the lobster. And she starts going, oh, I'm trapped. Where are they taking me? Oh, this water is so hot. It's...
It's really good.
So good. Oh, yeah. She is a delight as that. I would watch an entire movie of her being a pet medium.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
She has to solve some sort of a crime. Like the only, like there was a big murder and everybody died, including the pet dog. Mm-hmm, and she is the one who cracks the case because she communicates with the dog.
Yes. Or she has to divine from a case of tuna who poisoned the other tuna.
That is so much better.
It's all good ideas, and we can do a whole series as soon as Octavia's people get in touch with us. Remember that Castaway character you did 10 years ago? Yeah, we're just a random podcast with like 13 listens an episode, and we would love it if you would just come over here, put your hand into a vat of dead brine shrimp, and just tell us what happened in the apartment.
Okay, but going to Barry's hobby...
Okay, so Barry's like, well, I guess it's my turn.
Yeah.
And goes to the huge chest that he lugged all the way there on the bus.
Mm-hmm. You guys remember back 500 years ago when we were talking about the beginning of this movie and we had mentioned the Last Supper recreation in the box?
It's a shadow box type situation that has a little scene in it.
Mm-hmm. And so Barry pulls out these different shadow boxes.
There's probably seven or there's eight all together.
Right. He pulls out one about how...
The first one is mice dressed as monkeys evolving in that little crawl, crouch, squat, walk thing. And okay, so...
Yeah.
Okay. You guys know that I'm in love with Chris O'Dowd from the IT Crowd and everything else he's been in, like Moon Boy and whatever, right? The person who brought him to the dinner does kind of like visual assist him because of his blindness. And so his partner, I guess you might say, leans over and is whispering to him, and Chris O'Dowd goes, mice, dressed as monkeys. Excellent. I want to hold his hand. I want to hold Chris O'Dowd's hand.
So after that one, they go to like
500 years later. So this is the evolution of man and how these...
They were like, we can't walk direct. We can't read. We can't talk.
Oh, that last one was like, I can because I'm talking now. And that monkey was a dreamer. And so then he cuts to the next dreamer box. It's Tower of Dreamers, right? So he comes out the next one. He goes, 500 years later, the Wright brothers.
And he talks about the Wright brothers being dreamers. And then he talks
plywood,
about...
They were like, they told the Wright brothers, plywood is lighter than air and you'll never be able to fly. And he's like... And they were like, no, it isn't.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. The next box is the Vincent. No,
there's several, but they got like the Earl of Sandwich and Sir Francis Bacon, who created the BLT.
Without Sir Francis Bacon and the Earl of Sandwich, a BLT would just be a
lettuce and tomato.
He says tomato because he's trying to be fancy and it's so cute. But then, but then he talks about, I thought they were, it looked like he was trying to go in order from like oldest to newest, but I think, and you could fact check me on this, but I think Van Gogh was before airplanes.
I don't know.
I'm like nearly 100% sure on that.
I don't know if there was any specific, if he was trying to, that would definitely be in line with his character, but him failing at that would also be in line with his character because he does eventually get to Vincent Van Gogh and he says the best line.
It's so delicious.
And he says, everyone told him, you only have one ear. You cannot be a great artist. And you know what he said? I can't hear you. And do you know what Chris O'Dowd says?
He learns to this guy and he goes, oh, I'm a painter.
He's like, oh, really? Are you any good?
I don't know.
Because he's blind.
I hope to, in the near future, work with deaf, blind, and deaf blind people. And I sit back at this performance and I think it's so funny and so good. But I want to talk to a blind person and see what they think of it because it could be super offensive, right? But okay, if I saw Americans being made fun of the way that they were making fun of the Swedish at the brunch scene, right? If I was like, if somebody's like, oh, I love America, cheeseburgers, Confederate flags and monster trucks, I'd be like, not all the way wrong, I suppose. I mean, like, maybe not all my, but I know some people. Okay, I got you, right?
Yeah.
I'd be okay with that. But I'm not part of that community at all. I mean, like, I'm a nationaled community, so I have a kind of impression of how I feel if somebody would make fun of my nationality. I don't have this barrier, this, I'm sighted. And so, like, I don't know how I'd feel if I was blind and somebody was just like, it's so funny as an artist because it's a visual medium.
One of the first moments where I felt like I was an adult was when I could make fun of the groups that I was in. And like, if you want to make fun of liberals for being way too sensitive and maybe taking things way too literal, then, you know, I would probably laugh at that joke if it was actually funny. If you wanted to make fun of geeks or Christians and you did a funny joke that I was like, okay, that kind of pokes fun at us and not in a non-mean way, then yeah, I'd probably do that. But like the only area that I'm probably still sensitive about is people making jokes about weight, because I'm a pretty girthy lady. But it's still one of those things where if you're going to make a mean-spirited joke about my weight in the same way that they were going to be making fun of the Swiss in this, I would probably be like, yeah, I'm going to be a little bit like hurt by that.
I feel you, because when I learned to take a joke about a Christian, because I'm passionate but not vehement, like I know where my heart is and no matter how you feel, I'm probably going to stay there for me. But like, I'm also letting other people exist in their own spaces these days. And I'm working at like loving people like, well, like Christ loved them. But like, I find that I've gotten stepped on like that before. I think I might, now that we've discussed it a little bit, I might be able to caveat being okay with Chris O'Dowd's character. Because here's the thing. He's the only one who's physically disabled at this dinner. But also, they're all supposed to be idiots. So it's not that it's not the blindness that we're making fun of. It's the
fact that he doesn't know if he's a good artist.
It's the idiot interpretation of the superiority he has, this bolstered vision he has.
Right.
I love a confident person. And so like the fact that like an idiot's confident is hilarious. So I don't know. Maybe it's not much about his blindness because I've seen other stuff he's done and he just knows how to deliver a joke in a way that makes me laugh so hard.
Right.
The IT Crowd episode where he pretends to be disabled.
No, somebody thought he was special needs, though, and he went with it.
He needed to use a restroom, and the only one that was available was the special needs restroom. And so he gets in trouble inside of the restroom, and they...
So he fakes it. He's like, oh, no, I'm special needs. Of course I need... It wasn't a wheelchair, though. It was...
They did take him and put him in a wheelchair because he fell off of the toilet for something, and it was a physical bit, and then he was discovered inside of the toilet while he was on the floor, and so
somebody stole his wheelchair.
Yeah,
that's what he claimed. Who steals the guy's wheelchair?
And he was just like, "I'm disabled," and he had this really high pitched voice.
I don't know why he's comfortable making those jokes.
But back to Barry's hobby. He's got all these shadow boxes of these great people. And at the very end, when he describes them, he says, they were a dreamer. And then at the very end, he shows this mouse of his friend.
He goes, this is Tim.
And Tim has proposed to his girlfriend twice, and she has turned him down both times. But he still believes that he will marry her one day. And he puts Tim...
He magics out a f***ing wedding cake.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful.
And he puts the two mice up there.
There's a Julie mice whose eyes is closed and she's kissing him on the face. And he's mm-hmm. just looking forward like the happy, proud little Tim mouse mm-hmm. that was from like all of the film so far in his little suit, his little tie.
Right. And he says, and Tim is a dreamer. And that's the end. And it's this-
well, he flourishes at the end. Yeah. He does an inspirational speech that's like hilarious because it's like... It's like halfway there on all these platitudes,
mm-hmm.
and he just rouses the entire crowd.
At the very end, he says, when someone tells you you can't do it, you say, I'm not going to listen to you because I'm doing it already. And it's like a really perfect end to a speech yeah. that's all like, it's uplifting in a lot of mm-hmm. ways, even if you wanted to nitpick all of the details that are wrong.
Yeah. And what you see in the scene is that all of the guests of the jerks are like tearing up and they're like so profound, so sweet, so sincere, so inspirational. Mm-hmm. And then everyone else, the inviters, the jerks are like snickering and like laughing behind their hands. And they're getting roused too, but in this self-righteous,
mm-hmm.
humored way. And it's really good.
Yeah. And then we get a last guest arrival.
Okay, so Office Space this entire time, that guy from Livingston or whatever, mm-hmm. from Office Space, he's been trying to vie for this position this whole time. And it's kind of assumed whoever wins the night with their idiot guest is going to get this position. Somebody's like, Tim's got it in the bag. And he's like, night's not over yet. And then his guest, who's been absent until this point, walks through the door.
And his guest is Thurman Murch, Barry's boss, the guy who... his wife cheated on him with.
Yeah. He walks in a robe mm-hmm. that has tassels.
Yeah. And he comes in and he does his whole mind control thing on Barry.
Yes. And if Barry hadn't been there, it wouldn't have worked. The reason Office Space knew that Barry would be there was because he went to the office.
Thurman went to the office to go ahead and get more information because he's auditing Tim.
Yes.
And that's how they met.
And he makes Barry admit in the most heart-wrenching, saddest way that he had been cheated on. Like, he's like, tell them, Barry, tell them where your wife is right now.
She's in your bed.
And why did she leave you, Barry?
Because I couldn't find her clitoris.
Because I lost it.
Oh, because I lost it, yeah.
What did you lose, Barry?
Her clitoris.
Where did you look for it? Where did you tell her to look for it?
In her purse. Every time she loses something, it's always in her purse.
How would you recognize it, Barry?
I don't recognize half the things in her purse.
I thought it was a piece of wadded gum up under the couch. I thought I found it under the couch, but it was a wadded piece of gum. It's heart-wrenching and hilarious, and I only get got with that combination by Steve Carell and Zach Galifianakis. Mm-hmm. I cannot think of another set of people who can do that to me.
Right.
I don't think it exists.
It was a little bit cringy for me when Zach Galifianakis said, I found it in her naughty purse.
I found that clitoris for her. It was in her naughty purse. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. He ends with a flourish and he's like, I release you, right? And then Barry gets up and walks out, right? Mm-hmm. Rudd follows him. And here's where we're at. I've got my moral of the story if you'd like.
Yeah, go for it.
It is, you can laugh and enjoy people's passions, but who you think you are in relation to them matters, right? So all the idiots were genuinely enjoying the other idiots' skills and just loving on them, mm-hmm. laughing, having a good time, right? Enjoying other people's passions and encouraging one another. And the other people were laughing and enjoying the other person's abilities, talents, or even if you think it's silly, right? Mm-hmm. But they held themselves as superior. They held themselves as I don't look like a fool.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not okay because other people's dignity and integrity should be a priority of yours. I don't know. It just makes me mad. And so that was my moral part of the story. So anyways, this is the thing that Tim has just grasped. It does not matter that he's smarter than Barry. What matters is that he have the best of intentions for him
mm-hmm.
and to encourage him. Even if their goals I mean, their goals can be the same, even if the way they get there mentally is different. And so, like, Barry's out there and he's just like, he always beats me. He does everything. He's like,
well, and Red also comes clean and says that this whole dinner is to go ahead and bring a bunch of idiots.
And if you want to know, I think that Office Space, whatever the hell his name is, he's going to win hands down because he's trying to compliment Barry. He's like, you're not a bigger idiot than that guy.
Right. But Barry's still like, but he's going to win and he's going to lord it over me. Because here's the thing. Thurman doesn't know that he's being made fun of.
Yeah.
And Barry didn't really know that he was being made fun of until Rudd kind of brings it up and says, you know, kind of explains things to him. And even if he doesn't get it 100%, he still gets it enough.
Yeah, he's like, he understands that this is a dinner for idiots too. But when Paul tells him that Zach has won it, he's like, great, just another thing he has that I don't have.
Right.
He's got my wife, he's over me at my job, and he's won the dinner.
And then Rudd convinces Barry that while Thurman has mind control, Barry has brain control. And he kind of explains that Barry got into his mind and was like run around and laid all these eggs and everything.
Yes. And Barry turns around and he goes, it's better because the brain controls the mind.
Yeah. And then Barry,
I love that.
Barry goes back in for round two with Thurman. Barry's just like, he's laying those eggs into Thurman's mind.
At this point, what we as the audience understand is that we can get behind Barry wanting to win the idiot dinner because it's what he genuinely wants.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's not something he's losing. It's something he's purposefully winning.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And so they ultimately battle. They do like finger guns. And
yeah, he's like, I'm in your head. I've got you. Does it start with the verbal repartee? No, it ends with the shoot down from his personal.
So they go into like Barry's like, I have you. And he does this like, wah, and he like acts like he throws something.
What he ends up doing is Zach goes, Barry. And Barry goes, Barry. He goes, Barry, 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 Barry. I'm in your head. I'm making you say. Barry's saying this. He said everything after him. He's like, I'm making you say everything you're saying. And he's like, no, you're not. And he's like, aren't I though?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden Zach is like, he's controlling. I can see it. I can see the process. I'm sorry, Lydia.
It's like this tiny little twitch in his eye, but it's
that
enough.
Only Zach can do. Yeah. He's like, he's using his brain power to control my mind power, my mind control so good that I say it before he says it because he's powerfully making me say it before I say it. Like you can see this like tennis match in his head. Yeah. And it's perfect.
Yeah. And then they start like doing like finger guns and shadow throws and everything.
What do they call this? I called it pew pew party.
And like at one point, like Zach Galifianakis shoots an arrow and you see like Barry catch something in front of Paul Rudd's face. He's like, thank you. And he's like, you're welcome. And it's like,
and then Zach Galifianakis has his arm around the boss's head one time and he's like, gonna shoot him. Like, yeah. Like, oh, don't you dare.
And all of the like upper crusts are just like laughing and they're having a grand old time.
They're having an amazing time. And then it crescendos with Barry yelling all of these terrible things at Zach. He's like, you, after sex, you curl into the fecal position and cry to yourself.
Yeah. There's one other thing that he talks about before he talks about drawing a face on his penis and calling it Sammy.
I don't remember what that was because my notes just say Sammy. I remember the fecal position after sex. I don't remember anything else. But like, but then he's like, and then you draw, and now he's accusing him. And Zach the whole time is like, no, this, I can't. Okay.
Mm-hmm. He's like, oh, it's, you draw a face on your penis and you call it Sammy. And Zach's just
you
like,
you put a little hat on it and then you sing it a song.
And he's like, that's not illegal. But then Barry goes in he's like,
and then you sing him a song. And then now Zach is like, you can see him, like his blood pressure's up again. And Barry's like, obviously doing like this very intimate song that Zach sings to his penis. And then he ends it by going, Barry going, I release you.
Right before he does do that, he's just sort of like, I've laid eggs in your brain and you are now mine and I release you. And then you can see Zach Galifianakis just kind of like shudder just slightly. Again, these are very small things, but it's like through the body acting.
Mm-hmm.
And then like, and he feels like he's just the butt of the joke. And he just says, you're all audited, and he storms out.
yes, you're all, I hope you kept your receipts.
Yeah.
You're all going to be audited.
And then the boss informs them that they have a winner for the most interesting person.
Yeah, everybody cheers. It's the third cheering part. They're cheering the most.
Right. And
he pulls out a kind of gorgeous looking trophy.
It's a nice size trophy. And he gives it to Barry. Mm-hmm. And through the talking, they come to the realization that, oh, this was kind of, it wasn't necessarily planned, but am I getting that right?
Yeah, I think you're about there. It's, I think Barry exposits that this was for idiots. Mm-hmm. And all of the guests around the table are like, who weren't in on it, were like, wait, what?
Mm-hmm.
And now they're getting mad.
Yeah, and that's when the blind guy says,
wait a second, with his glorious accent.
Yeah.
Did you just say that this was a dinner for idiots?
Yeah, and he's like, you should be grateful that you are not feeling my wrath. And he walks out and he bumps into a waiter who is holding a plate of booze. And he's and he mistakes it as someone trying to, like, fight him.
Yes, he was basically ready to go because when they were grouped and congregated and were, like, congratulating him and then, like, the back and forth happened that let them all know. Chris O'Dowd at one point goes, so you're the winner. Whatever. But then the whole wait, did they say that we were idiots? And then he's like, you're lucky you haven't offended me to violence or whatever. And so he walks out, elbows a waiter who drops a silver tray. I know I'm reiterating everything you just said. Crashing all this brandy, I believe, to the ground, which is over 100 proof, which means it can set on fire.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
Yeah.
And then he's like, oh, so you do want to fight. And then he whips out his sword, which is like crazy sharp.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's ready to throw hands.
And he does. He starts like going after him with his sword and like fencing and everything.
And now people are having side conversations while this blind guy is whipping his sword around the room.
One of them is the fact that the Swiss guy says something like in German. Well, he's always talking in German, but Barry makes the comment, oh, the German guy who thinks he's Swiss, you're an idiot too. And
yes, and now he's super irate because he thought he was in on the joke and now he thinks he's out of the joke. And he's like, you did this to me. Was he the guest of the guy? The boss. Was he the guest of the boss?
I don't think so. I think he was a guest of the boss, but he wasn't an idiot guest of
the boss. But he super interpreted that he was the guest of the boss.
And the Swiss guy points his finger with his family crest ring on it.
How dare you? Something, something. Chris O'Dowd spinning around the room like a ninja with its lid off.
And Chris O'Dowd slices the finger off.
It is a clean cut just below the ring that says to the victors go the spoils.
And it falls down to the ground. Guy with the vulture. His vulture comes and grabs the
finger. It lands on the table. Because one of the things I love this so much is that like they're like, quick, get the finger. That's my wife's favorite finger. Right? The vulture grabs it and runs down the table. And the thing is, vultures aren't meant to run. They're meant to fly. And so it's like the super awkward diddle dance down the middle of the thing with him holding this ring finger in his mouth.
At one point, Chris O'Dowd slices candles off next to the brandy and they fall into the brandy and it lights on fire.
So now the room is on fire. There's a guy with a sword still swinging around. Everybody's screaming and it is pure chaos.
The handler of the vulture is like, let him out, let him out. Just open up a window, because anybody who probably is taking care of a vulture full time is like, that vulture probably has like a home, fly back to the home base, or, you know, it'll be easy to catch him again.
Maybe, I don't know. But what I do know is that in the know, we're going to kill it to get the finger back. Vulture's life was not worth that finger.
And that's why he says to open up a window to let him go.
And everybody who's idiot is like, yeah, right? So Barry grabs up, it looks like a bottle of Dom Perignon, if I'm honest. It looks like a very expensive champagne bottle because they're on the champagne course of dinner. Mm-hmm. And he goes to throw it and the boss says, don't you dare, or something like that.
Yeah. He says, like, if you don't you touch one more thing or I'll kill you.
So then Tim grabs the bottle, is like, well, then allow me. And then throws this full bottle of champagne through an elaborate coat of arms window. The whole thing shatters like glass.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you pay for, guys. A glass window shattered like glass.
It's a stained glass window. So I think that, you know, it may be fragile enough to where it would if you have a fully pressurized bottle thrown at it.
Well, the vulture's smart enough that it escapes.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tim turns to Barry and is like, should we get out of here?
Yeah. So they both grab up the chest and they walk out.
They throw it on back of the... They drive out of the parking lot. It's on the back of the Porsche. The thing is like the size of like half of the Porsche.
This is the wrecked Porsche, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And back at the apartment, Julie has taken her things and...
Barry walks up to a note that's on the counter. And Tim reads it. Barry looks at it and he's like, you could take that in a positive way.
How?
Have a nice life. Mm. And he's like, I messed this up. Tim is in full confession mode. I mean, I don't have the whole thing written down, but he's like, I'm missing out on a life with the person I love the most. And it's because I was selfish and mean. And I did all of these things without thinking, without considering. She walks in behind him and Barry's facing her. And just like in the barn, but reverse because it's awesome. Mm-hmm. He's like, and what other things? And he's like, oh, I just love her so much. And I can't believe I did all this. And
Tim says that, you know, the only reason why I wanted that promotion was because I thought that I had to impress her, but I didn't. She was happy with me just being who I was. And that was kind of her point throughout the entire thing.
That is accurate. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I'll never get to say that to her.
Yeah.
And he's like,
I think you already did.
And he turns around and he's like, and she's like, did you know I was listening?
And he says, no.
And Barry goes, I did. I knew you were listening.
Yeah. And so she comes in. They're kind of making up. Kieran comes to the door as well.
Oh, and did they do the full, like, marriage thing before Kieran or after?
No. I don't think they do any kind of marriage proposal at that point.
Okay. The talk of marriage happens after that then.
Well, I think it happens in the epilogue.
No. The marriage happens in the epilogue.
Okay.
The don't stop asking me.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Does that happen before or after Kieran?
I think that happens before. Let's just say it happens before.
Yeah, and people can fact check us and check it out on our socials.
Yeah.
Okay, so she's like, oh, I love you too, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, I will be who I am and like, I'll stop asking you to marry me. And she's no, don't stop asking. Mm-hmm. And it's very cute. And then Kieran walks in.
Yeah. And that's when Barry steps in. He's just like.
She's like, oh, Barry, I've got this.
Yeah. And he goes over and he tells Kieran that it's never going to work out with Julie and he needs to stop.
It's hilarious because you and I both know, and what our listeners may eventually know if they don't know it already, is that Steve Carell has excellent repartee with all of the comedians in this film, but none better than with Jermaine.
Yeah.
And so he's just like, you need to go. What you had with Julie was beautiful and majestic and burned like a thousand suns. But Tim got here first, so you're just going to have to respect it. And he's like, oh, no, you're right. And she's like, he's my client. We work together. And he's like, no, I have drawn a line. And Jermaine's like, yes, it's true.
Yeah. If we got together, we would have burned the world down.
To ashes.
Yeah.
You heard him. Burn the world down.
Ashes.
And like, at what point are they touching each other's face so much? Was it like just then at the end?
Yeah, it was at
they're
the
just,
very...
They like cup a cheek and then cup the other cheek and they're both just smashing each other's faces with their hands. It's a delight.
Yeah. And then Kieran leaves and Barry comes back into the apartment and all three of them hug. Mm. And it's like Barry is like officially a part of the group.
We should say that at this point, Jermaine, before he leaves, if you notice, he's wearing a skull, a bird skull. Like, okay, I've looked it up on Etsy. I kind of want one, a crow skull necklace. And he's wearing one. And it looks like the bird head he was wearing in the scene when he was dressed as a bird. But also, my notes might contain the word leather daddy, but I'm never going to admit that to you.
Outside of it in the podcast just now. Oh, it does. This movie.
Oh, then. Okay. So now that I actually look at my notes, the don't stop asking happens afterwards while they're touching each other's faces. And then. Okay. So Jermaine leaves.
Yeah.
And then like they're hugging and Barry throws his arms around Tim and Julian is like, we're going to be so happy together.
The movie ends on a freeze frame of Paul Rudd's face being like, what?
But then we get to the epilogue.
The epilogue that is done entirely in mice figurines in what you can only assume are shadow boxes.
Yeah, they are dioramas for all you mamas.
Yeah, let's see. What's the first one?
Breakfast of Champions.
Oh, yeah.
Me and Tim still get together once a month for what I call Breakfast of Champions.
Yeah.
And it's got everybody, all the people. Now they're having breakfast foods, mimosas. Guys, I want to go to Breakfast of Champions way more. Even though that lobster looked amazing, I would eat bacon with the vulture. I would have fried potatoes with that puppet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And they, let's see, I didn't write all
of them. I did.
Okay, good.
I hear the drums echo in the night. Hurry, boy, she's waiting there for you. It's going to take a lot to drag me away from you.
Africa. Kieran and Barry go on a tour. They do this art exhibit together.
They do curate a show and they eventually end up in Africa where they meet
Morgan Freeman.
Yes! His name was Nelson Mandela. They met Nelson Mandela.
And let's see.
Oh, I got the next one.
Rudd's character is like helping the Swiss guy turn his munitions factory into a museum.
Munich Museum of Modern Art, or MA.
and Kieran and Barry help them with a statue for their opening, and it's the finger.
Yes. And then,
oh, at the very bottom of it, do you know what it says?
It says, it's my wife's favorite finger. Yeah. Okay, so then to the next one.
Is that the wedding?
Mm-mm.
No.
Oh no. If you've gotten this, I'm gonna make you describe it. How can I do it? How can I make you remember who it is? If you wanted to figure it out, you'd have to be some sort of Sherlock.
Oh yeah. So Thurman he wrote another book.
No, I didn't write that one down.
You didn't write the one with
Nope, him? I'm thinking something else, but yeah, you should tell them about that one.
So Thurman wrote another book and it's super big in certain circles, like, and then the camera like pans out.
It's a mouse in a dickie, a little orange dickie like the one he was wearing in the office.
Yeah. And he it pans out to him being in a psych ward.
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. And okay, but the other one is, if I had a kink scene, I'd call it Darla.
Oh yeah, he does role play with Darla, where he's like, plays
Darla's super into role playing. And she had me playing a detective. She left a lot of clues.
And guess what? I found it.
But then he only says it. But the picture.
The picture shows Darla in a bed and Barry
dressed as a detective.
Dressed as a detective at the door, and there's all of these white arrows pointing to her vagina,
which is where you find the clitoris. Not in the vagina, actually. It's on the labia majora. I mean, it's enfolded in the labia majora. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have the internet, guys. Look it up. Do it incognito mode.
But the very, well, it's not the technically the last one. It's the second to the last one, where we have Rudd and Julie getting married in Paris. And Barry says that he had a gift for him, but it just never felt like the right time. And they're in bed and the camera pans down.
And they're naked.
And they're naked. And the camera pans down to Barry being under the bed. This is a throwback to when Thurman left at the party. He said that Thurman,
the reason he knew all about Thurman's dirty little after sex things, mm-hmm. he was like, Martha told you. And he's like, no. And then he storms out. And then he's like, I was under the bed the whole time. The idiot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Doesn't matter. He's under the bed. Remember I told you to look at the wine bottle that he had?
Yeah.
You remember what it said?
No.
Verda. Verda was the name of the director of the...
Oh, the French film that it's based on?
Yes.
Okay.
It's the director of Le Dîner de Cons from 1998.
And then that is like... That goes into the ending credits, but it's not technically the end of the movie. We get one last epilogue because this is a Marvel film.
Okay, so while we're watching this, like some of the job titles, there was mouse furrers and mouse wig makers, and just like the sheer number of titles of things for people of really obscure jobs was fantastic. But at the end of the credits, and I compulsively stay for the end of the credits, somebody's kid made that. Their mom wants you to read their name. Even if just by chance while you check your phone as the credits roll. Because you don't want to miss this. We roll back into another scene and it's this burnt down building and Barry's narrating like he narrated the other scenes. And he's like, Fender's house burnt down and his business went bankrupt. And Time magazine named him.
Forbes magazine.
Forbes magazine named him the biggest loser. And he's got this really genuine Steve Carell laugh.
Yeah.
A delight.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Ah. Okay.
So, Naomi, what would you say your shocked moment was?
Okay. It was going to be that there were so many dead mice, but now I know that it was overseen by the ASPCA and that no animals were harmed in the making of this film, which means the vulture was fine too. So I think my shocked moment might be just how much I don't give a crap about. And this is coming from somebody who doesn't watch a lot of romance, but I really didn't care about the romantic angle from this movie at all. She could have been out of it completely. He would have still had the character growth, and then that would have been fine.
Yeah.
What's yours?
I would have to say it was that legit. It was the scene at the end, like just the canon of the story in this universe with Tim and Julie that their wedding night was invaded by their friend being underneath the bed. It's super.
He didn't have any growth in that area, that no boundary there.
Well, it just seems really gross, the idea that someone is like listening in.
Yeah.
Like, it's one thing if it's happening to your wife cheating on you with, you know, your douchebag boss. Yeah,
she shouldn't have been there doing that, but they were where they should have been doing what they, you know, should have been doing. And he was invading that.
Right. And he just kind of, maybe that's more my shock is just Barry constantly invading other people's spaces without, like, how many times does Tim say, ask Barry to leave? And Barry just, like, ignores it in an effort to genuinely try to help. But, you know, you can help him do what he says when he asks you to be left alone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. What would you, Jen, you.
I could have done without a napkin that said I'm wet.
Gross.
That was just gross.
Absolute garbage. I don't know whose plan that was, but they should have their house burned down and they should be named Forbes' biggest loser.
Yeah. What about your most applauded moment?
Yeah, Jen, go for it first.
You know, I enjoy a good MacGuffin, and the whole dinner was a MacGuffin.
All right.
In the same way that volcano was a MacGuffin for Joe, this dinner was a MacGuffin for Kim and Barry.
Can you define what MacGuffin means to you?
It's the thing that is in the plot as described as the most important thing that the lead characters must get to or find or discover in order for the arc to be complete.
Am I your MacGuffin?
I would have to have an arc that I know about.
All right. I like the MacGuffin angle.
My applaud moment is probably just the artistry that went into the mice. Yes. Like, this movie was, like, so enjoyable because I got to see these little mice figurines.
I can second you on that. It's so cute. All the little details. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about it. I commented on something earlier today, and they were talking about how much they loved Coraline, and I got to see the Leica exhibit in Portland Museum of Modern Art. Mm-hmm. PMO. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know. Anyways, the detail in all the Leica pieces is insane. The articles in this film were on par with people who sculpt and shape frame by frames.
Claymation?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it. You're absolutely right. That is a wonderful thing to applaud.
Yeah.
They would have fit in Fantastic Mr. Fox just fine.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because they sculpted mice instead of using real taxidermied mice or realistic fake mice, the mice look a little Stuart Little. But they work.
Yeah.
And they suit the purpose and the sweetness of the character and everything. Mm-hmm. I'm with you. Would you like to know mine?
Yes.
My most applauded aspect of this film is that there were no characters with perfect features. There was no, I put it in my notes as like no redeemable character. But what I mean is that every single character had a flaw. Mm-hmm. If you love Barry, that's great. But you can't ignore the fact that he stepped on and through people's plans, no matter how important they were to them. Tim's character was blindly going after what he thought would give him the life he wanted, and he was losing the life he had that he wanted to maintain all the time. Super flawed Kieran with his like emptiness, but you know, if your whole philosophy rounds out to being life is sex and death, and there's nothing else, and you're a freaking artist.
Yeah.
So, like, he's just going to be unfulfilled, but he set himself up for it because he needs to be readable and transparent to his audience. But people are complicated, and if you limit yourself, you're going to feel empty and alone. And he certainly is a goat halfway through eating itself, and it shouldn't be deep, but that's what he is. And it's kind of amazing and still, like, super fucking hot. Mm-hmm. You can cut that out, Jen, but also leave it in because, Jermaine, you can at me. I mean, like, name any other character. There's no, except for maybe some of the, and this is only because we don't get to know them, the other idiots at the party who come across very, you know, gentle and genteel and maybe naive and stuff. But, and so maybe that's their flaw. But there's no perfect character.
Right.
There's nobody who you're just like, oh, that's Prince Charming.
I like the fact that everybody in this movie is a bit of a schmuck.
They really are.
Yeah.
I've never been to a dinner without schmucks, but it might be because I bring mine from home.
That's the podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you for walking with us. Check us out on Facebook at Shocked and Applaud or on Twitter using the handle at Shocked Applaud.
Enjoy June.
Thank you, Sean, for being our fact Sean. Sean Facts.
Sean Facts. Please know we love you and thank you for coming with us on this journey.
Thank you for patroning the peculiar.
Supper time has reached its delectable end, the plotter. Thank you so much for joining us in June for our review of 2010's Dinner for Schmucks. Still hungry after binging here? Bad Dad's Film Review watches movies and kids' television and just reviewed Murder on the Orient Express. Or, if you're looking for a robust discussion on the career of Jaimin Hansu, why not check out Munson's at the Movies, featuring a new actor every week? Hey, this is your audio engineer and that dinner guest who keeps talking and never leaves, Jen. Did you know that sharing or retweeting our episode posts are some of the best ways to help us expand our limited audience? As a commercial-free podcast, we rely heavily on friendships, not search engines, to help spread the word. Lydia already gave you our social tags, but here they are one more time. You can visit our feeds at Facebook using @ShockedAndApplaud and Twitter using @ShockedApplaud. We'll have a short break before we return with our next particularly cultish film on July 7th. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.
Yay! Yay!
Awkward ending is awkward.